Matt Whitaker, former U.S. Acting Attorney General.
This is such a great conversation about America, our future, what's going to save our republic.
We have a great football player. Matt Whitaker is here. Matt.
They tried to bury me. They didn't realize I was a C.
It's a touchdown. Whitaker.
Former acting U.S. Attorney General.
Under President Trump.
I'm going to be an unwavering supporter of law enforcement.
Welcome to Liberty and Justice with your host, Matt Whitaker.
Welcome to Liberty and Justice. I'm your host, Matt Whitaker. We're in season two. I think this is episode seven. And I'm excited to bring a friend of mine on, someone that served with me at the Department of Justice, Jeff Anderson. Jeff, how are you, my friend?
Matt, good to see you. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
And I should probably say that you have your PhD in addition to a lot of things, don't you? So maybe I should call you doctor.
You don't need to do that.
Well, we're gonna get into you and I. We're fast friends. When you came on board at DOJ in the Trump administration, you ran kind of the data part of DOJ, and but we had an immediate affinity because we're both huge college football fans, which we're gonna get to because you came out with a very interesting piece about the Rose Bowl, which most of the viewers and listeners know I played in 1991, but we're going to talk about that and the Big Ten and Big Ten expansion and playoff expansion and all that. But first, I want to get down to the brass tacks. You came to DOJ and you ran one of our big units that did a lot of the statistical analysis because you're one of those big brain data guys. Talk to me about your work at DOJ and kind of your observations during the Trump administration.
Sure. Well, so I ran the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is the statistical arm of DOJ, as you know. And it was, my focus throughout my more than 3 years there was on putting out the clearest, most accurate statistics we possibly could on all matters of crime and punishment, really emphasizing the issues that matter to the American people and hence to policymakers, and not doing the bidding of criminal justice academics or advocates, which is often the temptation, I think, at such places. And so I was always fighting against that and also trying to make sure that we actually put out things that were readable and understandable to the typical intellectually engaged everyday American citizen. Again, writing for everyday Americans and not for advocates and academics, and criminal justice academics, Matt, are even to the left of political science academics. So that's definitely not our target audience.
Yeah, and I want to dig deeper in this because when you came to Justice, did you have to change the culture of that division, or did you what did you find when you arrived? Was it filled with these ideologues who kind of adopted the hug-a-thug policies of the 8 years of the Obama administration that blamed the victims of crime and systemic challenges that are allegedly permeate our society?
Well, there certainly is, most people who work in such bureaus, a lot of them come out of criminal justice programs. They do tend to have something of that perspective, a lot of them. I would say that, there were not many clear ideologues when I arrived. Bureau of Justice Statistics, BJS, has about 55 employees. Fluctuates obviously a little bit over time, and I'd say we had a handful of true ideologues, almost all of whom were gone within a couple of years. They left on their own accord because they realized they, it's a new sheriff in town or whatever. But for the most part, I found the staff to be professional and committed to serious statistical analysis, and so it was a pretty good culture, I think, in general. And I did certainly try to emphasize to move us away from the notion that we're going to write for academics and advocates and more toward a focus on serving the everyday American. I really tried to instill a culture of accuracy, and that we're going to write reports. We're going to generate reports that are crystal clear as far as what we're showing. Often I think there was a tendency to say, all right, well, if it's relatively clear what we're showing, and maybe most people can't quite figure it out or match the computations themselves. That's fine. You got to trust the experts. I wanted it to be very clear what we were showing and not have that sort of trust the expert mentality. So in those ways, I tried to change the culture, and I emphasized things like, you know, for a while in the Obama administration, they were actually putting out what looked like BJS statistical reports written by the Urban Institute, for example, you know, a left-leaning group. And I put a hard stop to that and said, you know, we're not going to do that. We're going to put out reports that are from the federal government. The American people trust federal statistics, and we're not going to abuse that by having them be written by third-party entities. So there was some changing of the culture in certain ways, but by and large, I think it was a pretty professional culture all along.
That's good to know. When you dug into the data and you had a chance to do the analysis and collect what you wanted to collect, any surprises in what you found or anything that you think the viewers and listeners of Liberty and Justice would be interested in knowing about your work at BJS?
Yeah, I think it was more the case that when you just play it straight and you put out most accurate statistics, you find that a lot of the tried and true notions are right. That, you know, I think people who want to push a narrative, say, of, you know, mass incarceration, well, it's kind of debunked by the numbers that show the number of people in prison having gone down in recent years. We, you know, we put out a report on time served in the Obama administration. They quit issuing reports on how long people are actually in prison for certain crimes. And we put that out, and it was quite illuminating. I mean, even career staff would look at it and say, boy, I'm kind of surprised how short some of these times in prison are for things from murder to rape to, you know, down to drug offenses. So that sort of thing, I think, was very important. We put out a great recidivism study that just showed how many people who are released from prison end up getting rearrested. It was a 9-year report tracking people for 9 years after they were released. And I think it showed that 83% of people, if I recall the number correctly, were rearrested at some point within the 9 years. And it showed also that we dug down a bit and showed things like the people put in prison for drug crimes quite often were rearrested again for non-drug crimes. So the criminals don't tend to sort of stay in their lane, with the exception of, I guess, certain criminals like rapists and murderers.
Right. Well, I remember at the time of that report, we had a lot of discussions, you and I, and then, you know, obviously there was some interaction with the White House, who was, you know, we were working on First Step at the time as well. And I think you demonstrated how previous analysis, maybe at the state level, had kind of ignored, they'd gone either, done these longitudinal studies, but they didn't look at arrests. They looked at convictions, and they always had the window out just far enough that they didn't seem to capture this, you know, amount of people that were sort of going back to crime. Is that how I recall that? And you looked at arrests, not just convictions.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to look at, say, like a 3-year window and look at convictions, well, the process takes a while, right? So you're not going to capture necessarily a whole lot that's very meaningful. But this was the first year time was a 9-year study, and there's others in the pipeline coming out. And I can't take credit for the decision to do the 9-year study. That was already in motion. I had us dig down deeper on certain things, like that specific stat about how often drug offenders are rearrested for non-drug crimes, so that sort of thing. We made sure that was brought out in a way that it hadn't been in earlier drafts. But other than fine-tuning the report, making it more readable and zooming in on some of those key stats, a lot of that was already in motion. So, but it was definitely a very important study.
Yeah. And in my time, over 7 years at the Department of Justice as a U.S. attorney, and then, on the fifth floor at Main Justice, I was left, I think, and with an impression, and I don't think, I know this is my impression, is that there's really, all the statistics show that there's two ways to improve recidivism rates. One is in-house drug treatment, RDAP, in the BOP, and prison industries, kind of training, job efforts and giving people something to do and a purpose. Is that kind of what you have found as well? Or is there a third way that if they do more basketball practice, and guitar playing, that somehow that also might improve recidivism rates.
It really wasn't anything that we actually had a lot of stats on. That was more in the realm of David Mulhausen's shop, the research arm of DOJ, and they looked a lot at that, and I think it echoed what you're saying, but it was kind of, that was more in the research vein rather than the stats vein.
Yeah, interesting. You know, the other thing on the crime statistics. What's been happening with crime? You know, it seems like it's on the news every day. Our major cities, especially places like Chicago, Los Angeles, New York City, and other places, have seen an increase in violent crime. And do you have any sense if that was just a return to kind of the normal crime patterns? Is this an increase in crime? Has there been a change in law enforcement or anything that would explain, I guess, what anecdotally would suggest that our major cities have had a huge spike in violent crime?
Like, there's clearly a change in law enforcement in the wake of Ferguson and everything followed of basically communicating to cops that if they get involved, they're liable to be prosecuted or what have you for alleged racism. I think a lot of cops have backed off, and you see the effects. I mean, we've gone through these experiments, unfortunately, so many times where when police are engaged, we do the sort of broken windows policing. You don't have a lot of crime problems when you allow criminals to just sort of run rampant. When you don't enforce the small offenses, you end up with a lot of large offenses. We saw the greatly rising crime in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and then the efforts to enforce these time-honored ideas and the tremendous drop in crime starting in the 90s and then heading down from there for quite a long time. And then the subsequent uptick, I think, is just so far, thankfully, smaller example of the old patterns. I also think, though, there's a general sense of disorder in our cities that's even beyond the violent crime. And the violent crime is significant. Like the National Crime Victimization Survey that we did at BJS still does, of asking victims how many crimes were committed. It showed a 30% increase in 1 year in urban crime, violent crime. I mean, that's a tremendous spike in the most recent report, but also just the general disorder, the tent cities, the drug addicts, I have family live in Portland, Oregon. They're getting out of there, but the change across the last 4 or 5 years is just, almost unbelievable. All the West Coast cities, you see these tent cities everywhere. And the disorder is a key part of policing, I think. You know, the old classic Broken Windows essay by James Q. Wilson talked about how the real function of policing is to keep order, not just to enforce laws.
Yeah, exactly. You're a statistics guy. You're a PhD. You do data. You analyze things. And coming out of the Trump administration, see that you have your logo for your new initiative. Newer, I guess. You've been doing it for a little bit now. Tell me about the American Main Street Initiative and kind of what your work is focused on there.
Yeah, we started in 2021. And the American Main Street Initiative is an effort to be a think tank for everyday Americans to really talk about the issues that everyday Americans from coast to coast care about. We were very active, continue to be very active, like in the mask debate, the abuses of executive power, immigration, crime, a lot of the things that I think, establishment, quote unquote, elites just sort of want to ignore, but that most American voters actually care about. And we felt like that was a lane that wasn't being very well filled, especially in Washington, D.C., think tanks. And so started up, and we've got a great board of advisors that includes Fred Barnes, Michael Barone, Charles Kessler, and Heather McDonald. I'd like to think we've been moving the needle and punching above our weight.
Yeah, great people, all of them. On the masks recently, if you're read the news, you saw where big story, big headline, data proves masks don't work. And then there's been a follow-on criticizing, I believe, that research. How are you coming out on this, the mask, whether it's effective, not effective, and maybe talk just a little bit about kind of what you know and what you've seen?
Well, I did a deep dive into the scientific research on this in 2021. I spent months reading through all the randomized controlled trials, the gold standard of medical research on whether masks work. And there had been 14 of them, I think, at that point, that had been conducted over the last, say, decade. And collectively, as I talked about in an article called Do Masks Work? It was a City Journal. It was clear that the best available evidence showed the masks, there was little to no evidence masks worked to prevent the spread of viruses, and some evidence actually that they were counterproductive. I mean, they're kind of dirty and they just hang around your face and people touch them. And that article really made a splash. I was thankful it did. The Rand Paul tweeted it out. It's probably the most widely read thing I've ever written, actually. So this new report just came out by, it's a Cochrane review, a group that reviews medical research and comes up with sort of overarching conclusions from various specific studies. And they're widely reviewed to be the best in the business and widely viewed to be. And the National Institute of Health has glowing language on the website about how good the Cochrane reviews are. The Cochrane review comes out and says, yeah, masks don't work. And even the N95s, there's really no evidence that they work. So CDC, NIH, you know, all of a sudden now Cochrane's not to be trusted on this one point, as if they had any political motivation whatsoever to come out on that side. And they would have gotten accolades and they would have come out on the other side. But they played it straight. They showed what everybody knew all along, which is masks don't work. That was what all the public health officials, by the way, were saying too, until all of a sudden there was a magic switch flipped around April 1st of 2020. And they said, well, all of a sudden, instead of telling you not to wear masks, now everyone should wear a mask. And of course, when President Trump said he wouldn't personally be wearing a mask, then it became this big political symbol that you had to wear a mask. You know, it was
right.
It's a wonderful thing you could do. And they've always been such a horrible departure from centuries of Western norms. So I'm glad to see that there's more and more evidence out there that they do not work. And even if they did, it still wouldn't be worth wearing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're so right. And, you know, I'm always amazed, even here in 2023, when I go places and people are still wearing masks, thinking they're effective based on, you know, this research you point out. I'll make sure I link your story in the show notes. And in fact, while we got a chance, what's your website that people, when they do a deeper dive on what you're doing at the American Main Street Initiative?
Yeah, it's just AmericanMainStreet.org, www.AmericanMainStreet.org. I couldn't believe that was available, but we snatched it up.
Well, and that shows you how little most people think about Main Street America, right?
I mean,
it's literally, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I'm from flyover country. I'm from, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, as everyone that watches this show knows. And, you know, I'm a proud Iowan, and I'm always surprised how little kind of Main Street America matters to policymakers. It seems like the coastal elites run this country, and they don't think very often about the people that live a very wholesome, simple, and ordinary life. But
exactly. You know, look at the train wreck in Ohio and how much attention that's getting. What if that had happened like in the outskirts of Boston?
Exactly. You know, that's such a good point. Well, I think I can't hold back any longer. Let's talk about the possible death of the Rose Bowl. You wrote caught my eye, a headline that essentially suggested that the yearly matchup between the Pac-12 and the Big Ten may be going into the dustbin of history. As someone that participated in that game, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you think is going to happen, you know, not only to the Rose Bowl, but let's talk, you know, let's take a step out and think about these other bowl games that, you know, maybe their relevance is waning.
Yeah, I mean, the article is called Save the Rose Bowl. Again, it's a City Journal. And as you know, Matt, I mean, I was involved in the Bowl Championship Series and did a computer ranking that was used to help decide which teams would play in the national championship game, the Anderson and Hester rankings. I was also there that day in 1991 when you played in the Rose Bowl. Saw you catch that pass against my Washington Huskies.
Yes.
I'm glad you caught a pass. I'm also glad we won. But
you didn't only win. We lost, I think, 46-34. So the score suggests it was kind of close. We recovered two onside kicks, which I've never seen a team do in any football game. But we were outgunned by what I like to describe as a team that won the Rose Bowl that year, next year won the national championship, and the year after that went on probation. So, Don James had a good
– unjustly went on probation, I would argue, from some jealous fellow Pac-12.
Yes, it's nothing they did. It was just – it was only from their competition just being jealous. Anyway – you're an apologist for the Huskies. I'll give you the credit for that. That was an amazing team. I remember the first play of the game, I lined up against Steve Entman, who was unfortunately didn't have a very successful professional career. But if you can find that first play when we're on offense, you'll see me get driven back 5 yards by a guy in a 4-point stance. Good news is he did not make the tackle, so I was successful. But I just pretty much held on and had him run over me.
Well, it's not too many people who can say they lined up against a defensive end who is second in the Heisman voting. So that's
absolute stud. Absolute stud. One of the probably greatest football players I played against. And, we played that year. We also played against the University of Miami in their, glory. That was the 1990 season. So you had all.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Barrow, Jesse Armstead, Gino Toretta was their quarterback. That was in Miami, and then your team was Napoleon Kaufman. They had Mark Brunell and Billy Joe Hobert as the quarterbacks.
Right,
and I mean those were some great teams we played that year.
I guess Hennon was defensive tackle, right? Not end. You would know.
Well, yeah, but he lined we lined up in two tight ends, and he shifted out his head up on me. So that was and I had been guaranteed in preparation that the weeks leading up to that, there's no way that they would do that in the first play of the game, exactly what they did. But anyway, so why do we think we need to save the Rose Bowl? What's happening? You obviously, you come, like you pointed out, and people need to appreciate this. You developed really one of the first computer rankings that teams that hadn't played against each other, you could match them up. Now it's common in all sports where you sort of do these, power rankings, if you will, and you look at, all the analysis behind it, but you kind of created one of the first gold standards for doing that, and teams and the NCAA relied on it to match up the top two teams in addition to just the polls, the coaches poll and the media poll. But
I've gone back to the smoke-filled room to decide the participants,
right? So tell me, why do we need, what's going to happen to the Rose Bowl as we expand the playoffs from four teams to, I guess the plan is 8 or 16? I don't want to think about it.
12. Yeah, it's I love the Rose Bowl. It's probably my favorite event in all of sports. I think I've been there a dozen times, either for the Rose Bowl game or for a BCS National Championship game played in the Rose Bowl. It's just the most beautiful setting. And, it goes back so far, predates all the other bowl games. The idea with switching to a playoff was never to destroy something as beloved as the Rose Bowl, sort of perfect, Tocquevillian civil association, private citizens coming together and making Pasadena the center of the universe on New Year's Day. But that's what's happening. There's no guarantee going forward that ever again there will be a Big Ten Pac-12 matchup in the Rose Bowl. The powers that be have not even agreed yet to let the Rose Bowl be solidified as having its 2 p.m. New Year's Day start time, which allows it to have the you've been there, you've experienced it on the field, nonetheless. In the middle of the game, you're thinking it's bright sunshine. There's no thought of night by the time the third quarter is moving towards its end. The lights are on, the sun's setting, and the game ends in darkness. It's one of those great blends of natural drama and the sport and all of that sort of is in jeopardy right now. It's slated to just be a spot, a destination in the playoff, not something teams play for all year to get there, and not even necessarily played at the time it's been played at for over 100 years, following the parade and everything. And so it just doesn't make any sense. It's the kind of thing where America sometimes allows its best institutions to be destroyed, not kind of from a deliberate frontal assault, but from just neglect, ignoring that other plans put into place will lead to this. Yeah. There is a way that the Rose Bowl could easily be preserved within that 12-team playoff structure, within an 11-team playoff structure, which I propose. I propose concrete plans for this, where you'd have the Big Ten and the Pac-12 play every year in the Rose Bowl at its usual time and place and date, in the quarterfinals. And, you know, the winner of that would go on now to be one of the four teams that's moving on to the semifinals of the playoff. And there'd be exceptions for times when, like, the teams in those conferences are the top two seeds, or, you know, various other exceptions. But it's not that hard to do something like that. But so far, that hasn't been adopted, and the Rose Bowl really is in jeopardy of losing its status as an event, which would really be a shame.
Yeah, and I this is one of those things. There's more information than there's time to read it. But I know the NCAA is also thinking about having that first round be home games for the top seeds. So I guess it's a way for the big, you know, power teams, Alabama's, Ohio State's, Michigan's, don't forget Georgia, of course, Clemson. It's a way for them to have another home game and get all the, you know, ticket sales and revenue from that. I mean, you know, and you overlay the NIL, which we don't have time to talk about, but that what's going on there. And it's you know, it does seem like the Rose Bowl is certainly at risk for its not only its traditional matchup, but even its, you know, kind of its reason d'etre, its reason for being. I think it's and it is such an amazing institution, you know, with the Rose Parade. It's kind of, it's to me, there, I only watched two parades, I guess three now, since I participated in a Mardi Gras parade down in Galveston for the last 2 years. But nonetheless, parades are very rare. We don't watch a lot of parades. And I think the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and the Rose Bowl Parade are the two that most Americans catch. And it's going to be tough to maintain that tradition without the game corresponding in the timing of it. So I think you make some really good points.
The Rose Parade, I think, is, you know, the best parade in America, and it's dates all the way back to the 1800s. This is no small thing. And so I hope that the, you know, part of the problem here is that the Pac-12 and the Big Ten were always kind of the protectors of the Rose Bowl and of their own interest in it. And the Big Ten now has just decided to be this mercenary force that goes in and raids its ally, the Pac-12, and, you know, it basically steals UCLA and USC away from the conference. And it's really lost any interest in preserving these traditions. But college football has always been about the regional distinctions, the regional flavor, and then the ultimate, the pinnacle of the sport being like the, you know, the cotton, the sugar, the orange, eventually the fiesta, and ultimately, above all else, the rose. And you know, all of that seems to be giving way to a sort of progressive, nationalized, sort of sterilized version of the sport that looks just like kind of a pale version of the NFL. And that's not what makes people love this sport. And so, again, I'm not arguing against a playoff expansion per se, but it needs to be done in a way that preserves these games and doesn't sacrifice them for no reason, really.
Yeah, and as a, you know, as a fan of the Big Ten, obviously, with the addition of UCLA, that will enable the Hawkeyes to play in the Rose Bowl, the Rose Bowl Stadium, not necessarily the game. And so, but that is, having played in the game, I think it is very important to say that there's just more. There's more to football than just the game. There's a scholarship that goes along with it. I know we're losing that, but as someone that benefited from playing college football and getting an education paid for by playing football, but getting scholarship for my post-secondary education from the National Association of Athletics Directors, or whatever it's called, the NACDA, Directors Athletic, National Association Directors Athletic, it made a difference. And, you know, having Hall of Fames for the game and just all of those accoutrements that come, I'm using a lot of French today, Jeff, you bring out the intellectual in me, But having all those additions to the game, I think, is so important. And I'm glad you raised that issue. And, you know, I think the policymakers that are making these determinations on the playoff need to not just throw tradition out just to squeeze out, you know, a little more money out of this expanded playoff. And, you know, there's a reason you can only play one football game a week. And, you know, if you, you know, expand this playoff to at least three rounds now, I'm going to 12 teams, would you get a couple of byes then instead of 16?
Yeah. Four teams to get byes.
Okay. I don't know.
Four rounds for some.
Yeah, exactly. That's a lot of football on top of a 12-game season.
And of course, there's a lot of money, which is the guiding, you know, thing here. You know, a friend of mine, another Iowa fan, Peter Rao, you may follow his work some. He and I were at the Iowa Stanford Rose Bowl game. We weren't there together actually, but different parts of the stadium. But he loved the game so much; it was his first time going there. He said, "I don't care if Iowa ever ends up in a national championship game or whatever. I want him back in the Rose Bowl. I want to go again."
Well, especially after that game. Oh my goodness, that was Christian McCaffrey. Just first play from scrimmage went yard and it was over. And that was not good. Anyway, Jeff, congratulations on your success at the American Main Street Initiative. I will make sure in the show notes I link your website and the article on the Rose Bowl especially, but everybody can go to your website and check out all your other work. They can sign up for your newsletter like I have and get your updates as to your projects. I think you're doing some interesting work and helping kind of shape and direct policy, which is amazing. I consider you a friend, and I really appreciate you joining me here on Liberty and Justice.
I appreciate having a chance to talk to you, Matt. It's good to be on, and always good to talk college football, and good to talk about the masks as well, which are just, you know, such an insane thing. So thanks, and hopefully this will help, you know, save the Rose Bowl and keep people from wearing those masks.
Yeah. Well, that was Jeff Anderson from the American Main Street Initiative. You can check out his work on the show note links. And, of course, you can see everything I'm doing at Whitaker.tv.